Hello and welcome to the May edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor and later on I'll be joined by my colleagues Chris Collins and Dr. Anton Rosenfeld to answer your gardening questions. We're getting well into the gardening season and we're surrounded by seedlings. The garden here at Ryton has done its first tours of the year and we're finally getting some sunnier days. Later on, Chris Collins is joined by the fantastic Nick Hamilton, gardening author, owner of Barnsdale Gardens, and son of organic gardening pioneer Jeff Hamilton. Chris chats with Nick about his gardening journey, from working with his dad to taking over Barnsdale in 1997. Before we start, I'd just like to thank our sponsors, Viridian Nutrition. Viridian produce a range of award-winning ethical and organic supplements which include vitamins, minerals, herbal oils and balms. I love the way they call themselves the vitamin company with an organic heart. Their supplements are stocked in over 1,000 specialist health stores across the UK. So to find out more, visit viridian-nutrition.com. That's viridian-nutrition.com. Right, now I'm off to join Chris in the potting shed.
Hello, Chris. Good to see you.
And you, Fiona. You well?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm very, very well, thank you. Although it's a bit cold and wet.
It is a bit, isn't it? It's been a damp month. We've still got that easterly wind coming in, but to be fair, April's always a bit of a cold month. I don't see it as full-blown spring. It's get that. Now we're heading into May, you know. I think that's probably the time. I think what the problem is, we've had so much rain over the winter, we're at saturation point.
Yes.
You know, coming down here today on the train, you can see the farmlands. A lot of that, they can't get the seed in because all that water's just sitting. So we need a couple of weeks of sunny weather, Fiona. That's what
we do. But it's funny. It's also that time of year when you have a couple of days of sun and suddenly the pots that have been sodden, are now gasping.
So you've just got to keep an eye on them, haven't you?
You absolutely have. Yeah. I think this year more than ever, I've realised how important it is to observe your gardening every single day. I mean, things are so changeable these days that you can't take anything for granted, can you?
No, you can't. You've got to keep your eye on. I mean, it's always a big part of being a gardener is observation. You need to be looking all the time. And in a way, that's what's enjoyable about it, because you lose yourself in it, don't you? But you can't take your eye off it, especially even if you're gardening in small spaces with containers. If you just decide not to bother for a fortnight, then
they've had
it. Not going to happen. My one's particularly intensive because I seasonally plant. Obviously, I've got the bulbs are going out now, they'll all be naturalised, and then I'm starting to, all my tomatoes and my bedding and stuff will go in. So that's quite intense, But you can make it a bit easy for yourself. You can plant perennial and basis perennials or 12 month a year sort of roses, this kind of thing, but you still got to water them.
And actually, thinking about the conditions within the pot as well, we've talked about top dressing in the past, but if you're moving from, a pot that's contained, let's say, some spring bulbs, and now you're thinking, actually, I'm going to grow some salad or something a bit hungrier than a salad, what would you do?
Well, I remove a third of the soil.
Okay. Right,
a third
that's a really good gauge.
Yes, a third of it, and that'll get bagged, and it's a big job, so I live on the top floor. That'll get bagged, put in the car, driven down to the compost bin, use a top dress on my summer bedding, my summer bulb border. So it all gets reused, but then I'll put fresh compost in, fresh or peat-free compost, and then a few comfrey pellets, especially for the perennial stuff, will get sprinkled in there as well. So I do have a little policy of replacement.
Yeah, and of course it's the time of year where you might be removing your bulb trifle, which is the first time I have done a Chris Collins bulb trifle. I did several of them this year, and I'm not necessarily looking terribly forward, to kind of getting it all out again, because I want to reuse those bulbs.
Yeah, I would knock the pot out, and what will happen? What I tend to find with mine is they don't fill out the entire pot; they fill out a good portion of it. But what I'll do is I get a bit of tarp down, and I would tip the pot up, and I would gently close them apart in little groups.
Okay.
And then that would go out to my final spot. In my case, I've got my little area by the car park, and that's which is looking incredible this year. People stop taking photos of it. If you
that's
like.
Incredible.
Everyone said, "I don't know, tulip in it." And normally tulips don't naturalise so well, but they've really done all right this year. So that's where they all go. So it's a quite a big operation for me because I've got three floors to come down
yeah.
with it all.
Yeah.
But I just think it's worth it. None of those bulbs are wasted. They'll then over the years, it's been quite low maintenance. You don't do much, and that collection of colour has grown, and you get quite a spectacular display. So it is worth the effort just to go out and knock those pots off, free them up, and then replant them.
Yeah, it's a lot easier than trying to go in from the top with a trowel.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I plant very thickly, so that would be impossible anyway. So it's quite. And also, if you, I mean, the naturalised ones I've got this year, the daffs, I'll go around and deadhead them as well because I want the bulb. I'll do the same probably with the tulip as well. I want the bulb to fill out basically. So stopping it setting seed, I really encourage the bulb to thicken out and I'll get it all naturalised and I'll get more.
Yeah. And you talk about the border at the front of your block of flats, you know, which I'm imagining. In fact, I think I might have even seen a few sneaky photographs on your social media, Chris. But that is what we were talking about is kind of a bed. But you've also talked about naturalising daffs in grass.
Yes. Yeah. We've done a lot. Professionally, I've done a lot of this.
Yes.
There's a lot in the gardens at Westminster Abbey that we naturalised. But the great thing is they'll just come through in the spring. There's one called February Gold. I love it. It's a daffodil. And so what we've done with that is we peel back the grass. So you cut it with a half moon, which is like a special gardening tool.
Yeah.
And you cut lines into it and then you get a turfing iron and you roll it back. Then you plant into that bare soil. Big important thing, obviously, is don't cut the grass too quick once the daffodils have finished flowering. People get too excited. Oh, they've no colour now. They come along with the mower, they shut it down. You need at least 6 to 8 weeks of the after the plant stopped flowering to let the plant die down naturally and then cut it. So in a way it kind of ties in with your no mow May thing really. You know, you kind of, there's two rules I have in that maze. I don't want to cut the hedges because there'll be fledglings in them. And I like don't want to cut the areas where I've got daffs naturalised. But it's a very simple thing to do. And a plant like February Gold, which is the first daff out really, and it's such a sore out eyes. You can obviously there are lots of different kinds of narcissus and you can plant over the months. But they really like that environment. They really naturalise very, very well. And that's how they grow in the wild, isn't it? In grass areas. So.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. And it's not difficult, is it? The way you've just described how to do it.
It's very easy. I mean, I don't know if you can get turfing irons so much these days, but I'm sure there'll be other, you can do it with a spade. The reason I mentioned turfing iron is it's a special tool with a long handle and a flat surface, like a heart shape. And that means you can get under the turf very gently. And that means you can just roll it back again. You could do the same thing with a spade, but the turf wouldn't look as exact at the end of it. Yeah.
Well, I suppose we're not really, you know, trying to replicate Westminster Abbey standards.
No, we're not there.
Okay, well, I've actually decided with my lawn this year to slightly different approach. I've really been, we've been thinking a lot about biodiversity here at Garden Organic. We've just brought out a report called Every Garden Matters, which is absolutely true. Every garden matters, every single garden, doesn't matter how big, how small. And a diversity of planting is so important. Diversity of plants equals diversity of wildlife species. You know, the whole thing is so, you know, it's not just that it's important, it's also so us, if you know what I mean. It's getting to the heart of Garden Organic, the heart of the Henry Doubleday Research Association. You know, this is what we stand for. And one of the things that we do talk about in that report is the importance of long grass. And I've got a sort of slightly quirky garden in the sense that it's not a sort of particularly straightforward shape. And so what I've decided to do this year is to literally just mow a strip around the edge so you can see where my where my kind of paths and terrace finishes and the grass starts. I'm just going to do a strip round the edge, round the bed, so that'll be quite a kind of quirky shape, and then just a path through the middle. That's all we're going to do this year.
That's a good idea.
I can tell you Mr. Taylor was very pleased with that.
Where was it, a cube? I mean, they were one of the first sort of places to start doing long grass, and they do little mazes. You can do little mazes in there, and you and plug plant into it. Plugs are already quite cheap. Get some natives, plug plant into it.
Yeah.
So try and establish those plant bulb. I was there was an RHS garden down in Devon recently, and they've got all Narcissus bulbicodium and fritillarias all naturalised into the, and they take quite easily, and when they start to thicken out, it just looked absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Rosemore, that's the name.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah, no, that, oh, that's a lovely garden, isn't it? That really really is a fabulous garden. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And you know, you just would love to see some of those wildflowers coming through in the grass, and then just seeing the birds and the bees and all the rest of it benefiting from it. So that's the plan this year. How are you getting on with your seed sowing?
Well, I'm getting the next wave now. It's been a difficult year for seed sowing because there's two things that have happened. It's been because of the cold. That's been quite hard because stuff's got quite big and I've not been able to put it out because of the cold. But it's time now for the courgettes, the runner beans, the squash. You know, I'm gonna have a bean fest this year. And then hopefully the slugs will calm down because they've been an absolute nightmare. Especially the keel slugs. So it's been tricky because it's been so cold and wet. I suppose the wet's more important really because they kind of thrive in that moisture. I'll get on to the next phase of sowing seed certainly.
Okay, well, Chris, I have to confess once again, I have had a bit of a disaster.
Have you?
Yeah, I think I might write. You know, a book called The Disaster Gardener. I've decided, I think I am that disaster gardener. So I was very carefully and very successfully raising aubergines and chilies, two types of each. And they'd done well because I had them in a heated propagator in the greenhouse and I kept them wet. And of course, they particularly like it, you know, that kind of damp, moist sort of tropical conditions, don't they, aubergines? So these lovely little plants were doing really well. And then it's my own fault. I didn't check them for a couple of days and they damped off and I lost the lot.
Oh, that's a shame. Do well, pretty so. Why not?
It's late. It's a bit late for aubergines. So I've decided I've decided to also see if any of my nice gardening friends, such as yourself, might have any spare.
Well, I'm sure they will, but we've just grown far more than we need. I have an exchange system with Peter, my Irish guy, who's done two allotments up and he grows loads of stuff from seed. So there's always excess.
Yeah. See, I have in the past I used to struggle with I would be great at germinating, and I know I've talked about this with you before, and I would get these wonderful little seedlings and then they'd stop. And so this year I cracked that. I realized that they needed the heat, you know, and so I was sort of lavishing heat and water on them. I've never had damping off in this way. Last year, you might remember, I lost them all because they scorched.
Yeah.
And this year, it's damping off. So, I mean, every time it's a learning process. I am pleased to report that I've got three wonderful types of tomatoes, all from Heritage Seed Library. One lot from seed that I've saved from previous years. And so I've got 18 super duper tomato plants that I'm really pleased with. And they're good, you know, good sized plants now, you know, about 18 inches high, really come on, really pleased with those. So last year I lost all the tomatoes in the scorching episode. Yeah. I've done well with the carrots and I've done well with lettuce and I've got other things that are doing well. I tell you the other problem I had, and this is part of the reason I had everything kind of cosseted in the heated propagator, which has got a, you know, a close fitting lid to it, is I've got a mouse in my greenhouse. Yeah. And I'm sure there isn't just one. So I realized that if I could put my plants, you know, undercover and sort of in a nice sort of tight fitting environment, that would protect them from the mouse. So in protecting them from the mouse, I then lost them to damping off.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of says quite a lot about gardening, frankly. How to be a disaster gardener, exactly.
Well, so you do learn a bit. It sounds to me if they damped off, they were a bit too wet.
Yeah.
And I've seen the wild aubergine grow in places like Laos in Asia. Yeah. And they'll grow in really hot, dry conditions as well. So I think they are a bit allergic to it being too moist.
Too moist. Yeah.
A little bit, sort of keep it sort of dryish, damp but dry, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
and see if you get on better next year.
Yeah. It's that thing, isn't it, of you know, overnight, you know, 3 months work. Gone.
Yeah, it's disappointing, and it's a never-ending journey, a learning curve. I mean, I still make mistakes. Everyone does. Particularly with veg growing, which are quite intense. It's quite intense horticulture.
Yeah,
it's not like putting a border in with some herbaceous plants or naturalising some bulbs. As long as you do a bit of aftercare after that, that'll get away. Whereas veg are a bit more demanding.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm doing well with my herbs. I've got some chervil in. I've got some caraway in. I've got some oregano in, Are you getting on with your herbs?
Oh, well, I've just made a herb wheel.
Oh, I say.
It sounds posh.
That does sound posh.
Yeah, well, I had a pile of bricks down the lot and that I was been looking at, thinking, what will I do with them? And so I made them into a circle.
Okay, give us size. We've got a good dimensions.
Maybe a metre from the centre to the edge of the
circle.
So it's quite big.
Quite big.
And I'm going to sow coriander and basil and stuff into it as well. I can ground, see how I get on there. Although I had trouble with that in the past, but I'll see. But I just had a massive pot on the balcony, which was just overgrown and full. I've got lavender, oregano in it, marjoram, some rosemary, lots of few different types of mint. So I've lifted those out of that pot, split them up, and then I used them on the herb wheel.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, Chris, if you go down to your local supermarket this month and you pick up a packet of Yeo Valley spreadable, you will find a packet of either basil, thyme, or chive seed. The idea is that people reuse that spreadable tub and use it as a little mini seed tray. So just, you know, pop some holes in the bottom and grow herbs in it. Grow herbs because it's perfect size for your kitchen windowsill. Absolutely ideal. And so they're encouraging you to do that. And if you pop on their website and find out a bit more, sign up for their newsletter. It's really good. We're good friends with the Yeo Valley and they have a marvellous organic garden themselves. That they open to the public. They're keen gardeners. Great people. And I'm loving this time of year for herbs, particularly because they're so quick and they're so easy. But also the old perennial herbs are just, you know, doing their thing for you with no effort at all.
Yeah, they're one of the easy sort of group of plants to look after.
Yeah.
I talk about it in my blog on the newsletter this month, for last month, sorry, in April, just about how easy they are to grow. They're a very unfussy plant, as long as you give them a half decent substrate and it drains okay.
Yeah.
Drainage is probably the most important issue with them. Then you can just graze them.
Yes.
Like I do herbs in hanging baskets and graze them, you know. So I think if you were a beginner gardener and you're a bit nervous, you're a bit of a novice and you're a bit nervous about what to grow, that's probably where I'd advise you to head first.
Now, your hanging baskets just made me think, what about strawberries in hanging baskets?
Yes, I've done those.
Yeah.
If you're around and you've got a lot of time on your site, then I think that maybe like guttering is a really good way to grow them, strawberries.
Really?
Yeah, so you can do them upright drains and you can drill in and fill them with strawberries that way.
Oh, you mean the whole full circle?
Yes, yeah, so upright. Yeah, that's a good way to do it. But I'm not there half the time. I travel with work. So if you don't water that, then you're just going to come back to some fried
They're quite thirsty, aren't they?
I hear a lot about people growing stuff in guttering. And that's fine if you're there every day, but if not, they're just not going to last really. So a basket just gives you more space to grow them in, and you can get a good old soak.
Yeah,
you know, they're quite hardy parts.
Yeah.
But I've grown them in baskets before, and I tend to mix them in with a bit of petunia, so you've got the colour and you've got the fruit.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. I've acquired a bit of a strawberry planter, which I don't want to throw out. Somebody's passed it on to me, and it's made of plastic, I'm afraid. But on the other hand, I want it to be reused, and so I've got that planted up this year, partly because I can then protect it a bit. Because that's the thing, you know, strawberries are delicious to lots of creatures.
That's the reason I put them in a hanging basket. I'll get kill slugs out of the garden first.
Yeah.
And woodlice move in after. Yeah. Everybody loves a strawberry.
Oh, golly, I tell you. The amount of kill slugs I've removed from the bottom of pots in my greenhouse. I use your trick now. You told me about, use a pair of tongs.
Yes, your barbecue tongs. Maybe don't use them for the barbecue.
No, maybe not. But the thing is, if you do them with your fingers, which, you know, it's fine. I'm not squeamish about it. But you can't get that slime off.
I prefer the tongs. Off.
Yeah, I think the tongs is a good way to go.
Yeah, a good way
to go. And then I just pop them at the back of a bed and hope that the thrushes come along, you know, quickly for us. Tell us about the allotment then. Chris.
Yeah, it's going all right. It's been. I'm just behind to where I was last year. The last few years,
I'm glad you said that. It's not just me then.
No, I think so. Even the other allotments down there, I've been looking at. I'm always a bit nosy. I like to look for a bit of inspiration. Even there, it's still quite empty, most of them. I think we've had some really hot springs the last few years, and I think that maybe has thrown people out a little bit. So basically, I've been holding back, you know. So I've got some rows of salad in. I've got some carrot in. I've got some beetroot. I'll start all my tender crops now, but they obviously stay protected environment. I've got my tommies and that all sat in the greenhouses and the polytunnel, but I'm holding back. I'm fleecing stuff still as well. The thing about it is, it's come the end of May, the soil will warm up properly. You only need a hot week and everything will catch up. So my advice to anyone listening, if you're worried, oh, there's nothing moving at the moment, that's probably down to soil temperature. The soil's still quite cool. Plants will just sit and wait until things are more favourable. So I wouldn't panic too much. You'll get to June and you'll go, oh, blimey, everything's growing like mad now.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting you say that because, you said something earlier about, you've got to really look after food, any food growing that you're doing, any veg growing. It's, you've got to really, keep an eye on it. So we're waiting for the conditions to turn perfect for the veg. Yeah, get that. But I've noticed that perennial flowers are out probably 3 weeks earlier than I would expect to see them. So we've got a beautiful ceanothus here at Ryton.
It's very early. They haven't
It's
sorted out
really
sorted
too
out. Yeah,
early.
well, most of my bulbs were early as well, to be honest with you. And I'm not talking about pots, I'm talking about in the verge. And
Right.
so, we don't get hard frosts. I don't know about here, but in London, I'm not seeing any hard frosts. And then, so you've got two outcomes to that. Things are going early. Plants are opportunists. You know,
Yeah.
if they think, oh, this is the time to go, I'll go. I don't really old blame them for that. So,
Yeah, yeah.
the plants are opportunities. Another thing is that obviously you get pest and disease build up, which you might not have if you get some nice cold weather. And so you're kind of dealing with these two fronts where the weather's changed, the plants are reacting to that. And then also you've got pest and disease because they're not getting killed off by hard cold weather as well.
Yeah.
So we kind of, since I started, it's 40 years ago I started being a professional gardener, and
Yeah.
I can see the difference. And I know 40 years in the wide scheme of things is a tiny, tiny, tiny speck of time. But I can see the seasons have moved. It feels like the seasons have moved and blurred in a little bit. You know,
Yeah.
that's how it feels. And maybe next year I'll be proven wrong.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to pause for a minute, Chris, because you just mentioned that you've been doing this for 40 years now. Haven't you just had a little bit of an accolade or two?
I have, yes. It's I've hung around so long now, they've given me stuff. That's right. So I was made a fellow of the Institute of City and Guilds.
Wow.
Which was that was a incredible day. We got to wear robes and hats and all this
Oh, the
sort of,
whole
and I
thing.
was with Jade from the repair shop, who was there
Oh,
as well. And
fantastic.
that was quite emotional. And
Yeah.
obviously that started me off on my journey with City and Guild Phase One every Friday up at Stammer Park in
And you were the
Brotherhood.
tender age
I
of
would have been 16 then,
yeah,
the end of
oh, that's amazing.
17. So that was really, and then the Institute of Horticulture, the Chartered Institute of Horticulture, also offered me a fellowship, which I get presented to beginning of May. Yeah, so it's
Yeah.
been quite emotional, really. Yeah, it
Yeah,
has.
yeah.
And you get more letters after your name, so you feel very flash about it.
Yes. Yeah, it's very
Yeah,
important. We're in the
yeah.
presence
Yeah.
of
Well, it's the
greatness.
thing is, to be acknowledged by your peers is the greatest
Yes.
compliment you can have, I think. And
Yeah.
I have worked with some, I've been so lucky, I've worked with some amazing gardeners over the years. Andrew Slater, who started me off, George Anderson from Beech Grow, he was very influential on me. Roy Watlin, who was the pathologist I worked with on entomology and mushroom collecting, was a big thing of mine, was at Edinburgh. There's just been people along the way, dotted along the way, that have just really influenced me, that really impressed me, and really drove me on to do what I've done.
That's amazing. Well, well done. Congratulations
Thank
from all
you.
of us because, we're so lucky to have your expertise and have you as part of the team here. It's just brilliant. And I'm so glad that you've had this recognition. I think it's great. And it's great to get the two in one go.
Yes, it is. I told you I've been hanging around for 40 years. We
Yeah.
better start giving stuff to Chris.
Exactly. It's like buses. Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Well, but when you are, down the allotment or on the balcony, let's just look at what are the jobs we've got to do this month.
Well, it's a planting up month for me, really.
Okay.
That's where I'm aiming. I've still got bulbs to take out. There's some tulips still. I've got lovely cream tulips going there at the moment. I'll wait them to go. But yeah, it's the changeover. That's how I see it. And obviously,
Yeah.
the allotment, I'll be much more reactive, a bit more of a weatherman with that. I will look at
Yeah.
what's going on and time it that way. But yeah, it's the changeover. To me, May is the most exciting month because you get so much done in it, hopefully. And
Yeah.
that you're then June, July, you're into the rewards of your work. And we were talking about it just up at Ryton. I was talking to the Heritage Sea Library staff, Marcin and stuff, and we were talking about how amazing fresh food is out the
Yeah.
ground, and so that drives me on, really.
Yeah.
So now is busy, busy time. The only trouble is for us, isn't it, is also we've got to go to work. And I'm sorry,
Yeah,
I'm
shame
a
about
born
that.
boomer, I'm a gardener's world. I've got all this other stuff going on, so where the hours come from, I don't
Yeah, well,
know.
that's my problem because and I'm sure we're not alone in feeling massively behind at the moment. And the garden is looking, sort of green and full and, but it's not quite really where I'd like it to be in the sense that, I've not had time to clear some, clear some patches in order to sow some things and you know, just this sense that it's getting away from me a little, partly because I'd earmarked some time in earlier in the spring, took a few days off work with the intention of you know, getting started, and it was cold, wet, miserable, and it's thrown me off, really. So what would you say to anybody who's listening who's a bit like me, thinking, oh golly, maybe I've left it all too late?
Oh, definitely not. Absolutely definitely not. You can definitely catch up. You do need to put some time aside for it, and that's all. Yeah. Keep on seed sowing, keep on doing, you know, creating plants. I think the important thing about it is gardening shouldn't be a pressure, it should be a pleasure. So even if you're out there and it looks like there's too much going on, try not to focus on the bigger picture. Focus on little bits of it and get them in order, and just enjoy being in the air, being around the plants, listening to the birds.
Yeah.
You know, to, to me, it's like a therapy. It really is.
So break it down.
Break it down, do bits that are manageable, and don't look at it overall, because then you think you become
it's
overwhelmed.
Too much. Yeah.
And that's not the reason for gardening. The idea of gardening is you step out of life.
Yeah.
And you have some space for your mind. And so my advice is to pick small jobs out and just chug on with them.
Yeah. Okay. That's very, very good advice. I like the sound of that. And it's a wonderful month, May. It is, in fact, my favourite month of the year. It really is. And it's so full of promise. And it starts very differently to how it ends.
Yes, and I love it. I just think it's the time, you know, the sun will come out in May and you'll be right in your garden or in your allotment, surrounded by your plants, and you'll just, you know, your soul will light up, and then, you know, what's not to love?
In 1997, Nick Hamilton had what seemed like an impossible task. Take a collection of 30 or so organic gardens designed for television and turn them into a profit-making visitor attraction, aiming to educate and inspire people to grow organically. Chris Collins chats with Nick, owner of Barnsdale Gardens, about his journey since taking over, memories of his dad, and what makes Barnsdale so special.
Well, today on the Garden Organic podcast, I'm privileged to welcome a really special guest. I'm really chuffed, and I know Garden Organic are as well. So I've got with me Nick Hamilton, who has been in horticulture a while. He's the author of two gardening books. He contributes to magazines and does a bit of telly from time to time. Obviously, the son of the great gardening legend, Jeff Hamilton. Nick is also, you're a horticultural expert in your own right, aren't you? Went to Rittle, worked in the nursery industries before coming back to Barnsdale, working with your dad, and then you took it over. And in 1997, you opened it to the public. Nick, welcome, my friend, and thank you so much for taking time out to speak to me.
It's an absolute pleasure, Chris.
So, obviously, Jeff was a pioneer. What was it like growing up in a family where organic growing was such a passion? Did it kind of seep into everyday life?
Oh, absolutely. It started, I suppose, when I was little. I mean, organics in the 60s wasn't really something that was bandied about, and he was, you know, landscape gardening and stuff like that. But even from the word go, always a composter, everything composted. And of course, when he realised that organics was the way forward, then our life changed quite a lot, really, I suppose, in the way that we did things and the way that we viewed things. And, you know, it always makes me laugh, you know, with the sort of the recycling and all of that. I mean, you know, obviously as an organic gardener, we do lots of recycling naturally, and gardeners have been doing it for millennia anyway. So, you know, I think we've all been doing our little bit in organics, but maybe not as far as we should have done.
But now it's interesting, isn't it? Because we're the centre of a trend in a way, aren't we? Everybody is suddenly talking about organic, recycling, environment, this kind of thing. Do you think the trade change much a lot over the time you've been in it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think more with the amateur gardener, more the way that people view it more than anything, and the fact that it doesn't seem as out on a limb as they thought it was. I think that people want to be told that it's not complicated, it's not difficult, it's easy. And of course, I do say to people, I mean, as an organic gardener, because you're working in tandem with nature, then nature's helping you along the way. The point is that it still blooming well doesn't give you any more time to sit back and put your feet up. There's always stuff to do. But the point is, with it coming into the mainstream and it being spoken about a lot more, it doesn't seem so complicated, and people realise that actually it's a lot easier than they thought, and they're more prepared, therefore, to give it a go.
Yeah, certainly. You know, we're not seen as outsiders so much as we want. In fact, we're driving it in lots of ways. And do you think, even commercially, in nursery stock production, something like, you see more biocontrols and organic methods going into that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And also, I think the fact that we're now moving away from everything being absolutely perfect. I remember years ago, you know, a lady came in and she bought a plant into the nursery shop, and I say nursery shop, it was a shed in those days. And she paused it. She said, do I get a discount off this plant? Because it's infested with greenfly. And I looked at it and I said, so where? And she said, there. And there was one greenfly on a leaf. So finger and thumb. And I went, oh, that. And I said, not anymore. but the point is, we've moved massively on from that. And now people are accepting that everything, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be perfect. So I think that is a massive change, you know, in the amateur side, which obviously then has an effect on the commercial side, where there is less reliance on chemicals, because they understand now that they don't. Yes, we don't want them infested, but a little bit of damage, people don't turn their noses up anymore. So, you know, it's a nice balance now. And so therefore it gives the opportunity to use those natural predators where, you know, it is as within our garden, you know, nature is a balance between pest and predator. So it's never going to be perfect, because it's impossible, because there always has to be the pest there to feed the predator.
Yeah, so certainly amongst younger people, they don't want that in their, you know, they're aware of the environmental concerns and they're aware of making sure that nature's got a role to play in their lives as well.
I think, to be fair, a lot of it, you know, has been also driven not just by horticulture, but by the culinary side of things. So you're getting younger people trying, you know, to grow herbs in particular to use in their cooking, and maybe one or two veg in containers or on a balcony or whatever, or a little bit in their garden. And of course, they don't want chemicals on what they're doing. So in actual fact, a lot of it has been driven through, you know, from different directions as well. It's not just purely coming from horticulture.
Yeah, the worlds of diet and gardening are fused, haven't they, in many areas?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a good way for us to get our messages over as well. We've got a bigger audience to play to, haven't we, in that respect?
Yeah, absolutely.
So going back to Barnsdale, you did some time in the wholesale nursery industry. So you went back to work with your dad. What prompted that decision? Why did you decide to do that, Nick?
Oh, what a nightmare. No, it wasn't a nightmare. It was the best thing I ever did. I mean, we'd spoken a lot about setting up a little business together. Obviously, you know, it was something that he was keen to do with me, and I was obviously very keen with him. And the opportunity sort of arose for me. I was in between jobs, and I was sort of, you know, ready, really, I suppose, to do something. I don't think he was quite ready, but you know, with a bit of gentle arm twisting, the opportunity came up, and it was actually the opportunity to buy just the piece of land at the end of the gardens there, which was just perfect, as it turned out, as a place to set up a business. So I'd been there. I went back to Barnsdale full-time in 1989, and my dad, while I was between, you know, obviously I told him I was between jobs, but he basically paid me enough to run my car and to eat and to pay my rent, and that was it. And I worked sort of 6 days a week for him, and was more than happy to do that. And then obviously when we bought the bit of land at the end of Barnsdale there to develop the nursery and the garden area there, that's sort of when I added a day to my week, and I think I've been doing that ever since. But it's been great. And, you know, working with my dad, we had such a terrific working relationship. So, you know, having that fun and enjoying what we're doing was a primary part of what we do. And, you know, in horticulture, that's a big part of what we do is the enjoyment side of it. We get so much satisfaction from that every day. It was a great time for me.
I suppose as well, they will say, you know, it's not easy to work with family, but I think that doubles the bond up if you can do it and it works.
Yeah, we had a fantastic relationship. I think in the 7 years that I worked with him before he passed away, we never had a cross word at all. I'm not the sort of person who loses his temper quickly. I'm very laid back, and my dad was too. You know, we discussed things. We might have, you know, not aggressively, but we might have argued about stuff because whatever. But he was asking, you know, because I'd been to college quite recently as well and had newer ideas, and he was asking me lots of questions. And certainly when he decided to go peat free, it was me that was doing the trials with the peat free, and he was getting the information coming from the nursery really, and then developing that for the viewers on Gardeners World. So we had a lot of sort of crossing with information and help as well.
That's interesting. You mentioned peat free there, because again, you know, that shows how long that debate's been going on, isn't it, in a way? And I take it the Gardeners World cameras would have been around during this time as well.
Yeah, I tell you, it was a strange time, really, because when you work all the time, it you lose track of the days. And it was sometimes difficult to remember when a Friday came round, because they used to film on a Friday exactly a week before the programme was broadcast from Barnsdale. That's when they did their filming, the week before. And some Fridays I did think that, you know, they could pick up my breathing on the sound equipment that they have, and that I had to stop breathing because I got so many phone calls. Hey, is that you hammering?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah, I forgot it was Friday.
Television.
Every day of every year, we're never quite sure what the next day is going to bring.
Yeah,
and that was sort of the same sort of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not predictable, is it? You know, like, I mean, the last couple of years, you know, I had one year which is amazing. Incredibly wet, and all the brassicas did well. And last year, it was really hot, and you get good tomatoes. And so, you know, it's kind of everything's always moving. It's very fluid, isn't it? Really. And if you add telly into the mix as well, then you're right into it.
Yeah, yeah. The spanner was thrown quite often into the works. Is way of describing it.
Yeah, that's about right. You're a businessman as well, and that's what you had to do. You had to turn that into a business, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've never really looked upon myself as a businessman, to be honest. I sort of hit the ground running in 1996 with having had no business experience prior to that, really. And I'm still running. I'm still learning. I'm now 62. I think in gardening, you never stop. In horticulture generally, you never stop learning. And I think in business, you never stop learning. I'm a much better businessman now than I was then. I wish I knew now I knew then what I know now. But my dad was a terrible business. He was a terrible bit, which is why the garden centre went bust, you know, that he had in Kettering and stuff. And I talked to, you know, somebody, I spoke to somebody about it just the other week, and they looked horrified when I mentioned it. And I said, no, don't worry about it. I'd like talking about it because it was the best thing that ever happened to him, because without that going bust, he'd still be there. Sent him down the journalistic route, because he needed something to earn some money, and he just thought writing, he might be able to do some writing. So he tried that. So I think the one thing that for me was always the driving force when my dad passed away was the fact that the legacy that he left was always going to be there. And it took me quite a number of years to realise that his legacy was not the garden, actually. It's a great thing to leave, but that's not the legacy, because as we know, you know, a garden is a work in progress. My dad always said a garden is a work in progress. That it keeps rolling on, and we're not historical, so therefore it keeps developing and also changing continually with new things that we do. His real legacy were the millions of people that he inspired to get out there and garden. That's his real legacy, and obviously that's passed on to children, grandchildren, so the legacy is still rolling on. The gardens were started by him and developed by him, but, you know, and he will always be embedded in that history. But if he came back today, he probably wouldn't recognize 2/3 of Barnsdale. You know, I don't have any problem with people referring to me as the son of Jeff. I'm very proud to be the son of Jeff Hamilton, but I also do plough my own furrow, and I'm quite happy with a merging of the two.
Yeah, so, Barnsdale is very much a Nick Hamilton garden now, isn't it, really? You're the one that's brought it on all over these times. And I always think with a garden, nothing stays the same, probably, apart from the trees, you know, and it revolves and moves around, doesn't it, all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that a lot of people don't realise is the fact that my dad was at Barnsdale for 14 years developing that garden. I've now been there for 27 years since he died. So I've had control of it for 27 years. So it's nearing, you know, twice as long this year. So at some point, it will be twice as long as he was there. So it is, you know, although there, like I say, there are still bits of him there and bits of things that he developed. It's quite funny. I mean, you know, people get very carried away with themselves, and they keep telling me what a great innovator he was and what a great man he was and all that sort of stuff, and they're talking about particular gardens that he developed, and I can't tell them that it was me that had done it.
You're a very modest man, Nick, you know that. You are.
Well, they're getting so carried away, and you just think, I don't want to burst their bubble.
Yeah, sure. That's kindness, that is. Yeah. And then when the garden opened, I suppose it going back to saying how organic horticulture was viewed back then, and obviously Jeff had sort of brought it to the profile on garden as well. What was the sort of reaction of the first people that visited it? Did they come in? Did they want to know about garden? Were there a lot of questions? They wanted to know about organic techniques, or how did it go down initially?
Yeah, I think the biggest hurdle that we had to overcome was the fact that nobody had ever seen the garden complete. And nobody realised actually how the garden had been managed. After my dad had passed away, they did a five-programme series about him on BBC Two. And for part of that, they hired a helicopter to do an overhead shot of Barnsdale because nobody had ever seen it complete. On the one really foggy day that there was, and they couldn't afford to hire the helicopter again. So nobody ever saw it. So people came only having ever seen, you know, small parts of a jigsaw, but they had no idea how, or the individual parts of a jigsaw, but no idea how that jigsaw fitted together. So every week they're seeing odd little elements of Barnsdale, but never it all complete. So I think that that was the difficult bit, was the fact that it was maintained, always maintained to a level, but never pristine. Well, not, it's not pristine now, but never to the level that it was maintained, it is maintained to now. So I think the initial thing was the fact that, you know, we got to a stage where we had it, as far as I was concerned, in a fit enough state to open, but it's improved year on year on year. And I think that's the thing people have been coming. And a lot of, most of the questions are horticultural. What do I do this? What do I do that? But an awful lot, really right from day one, about organics, because it was such a prominent thing. And I don't, it's funny, you know, because I always thought that he was very clever in the way that he did things, in that, you know, if ever he mentioned about fertilizer, for example, then he would always talk about his organic fertilizer first, and then just mention that there's an inorganic one as well, if you're not organic yet. Yeah. And always use the organic one first. So that was what he was putting in people's heads. And you don't realize actually until after he'd gone that it actually stuck in people's minds, because they were right from day one asking about these things. So, you know, I think they surprised themselves as well, that they were that interested in it. So lots and lots right from day one about organics, and we still get it now, organics and peat-free, obviously more so now, with that becoming much more prominent.
That's really brilliant. That really is. And it's interesting how that, to use the pun, he sowed the seed, didn't he, really, in people's minds about that word organic, which would have been dismissed not many years before, really, in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really clever, and that drip, drip, drip of that has worked fantastically well, you know. And I think was the real push that organics needed in that respect, to bring it right into the mainstream.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Did a brilliant job, and you've obviously carried that on. I'm going to ask you a question now. I don't know how easy this is to answer, I suppose. We get a lot of the people listening to podcasts come from all over the world. So I wanted to just paint a picture, really, I suppose, of Barnsdale, you know, the surroundings and how you feel about it. You know, the sort of, does it make sense when you look at it and how it makes you feel?
My life for the last, 34 years has been Barnsdale, really. And like I say, I spend every day there. So to me, it is a little paradise. It's fortunately, I think it's set in Rutland, which is a beautiful county, and it's very rural, which is lovely. The RAF are no longer at Cottesmore, so we don't get a problem with the planes. So it's nice and peaceful as well, which is great. No tornadoes flying overhead anymore, and things. So it's a little oasis. And I think that, you know, for me, the thing with Barnsdale is it's a combination. I go to work to enjoy my environment. You know, it's now I'm 62. It's harder to leap out of bed, but I still try and leap out of bed every morning, you know, desperate to get to work. And it's such a great feeling to have, you know, but I think just the fact that we're close enough to the main road, but also far enough away so that it's peaceful as well. You know, it's a really lovely environment. And to be wandering around and hearing all the bird song, it's lovely to hear the wildlife as well.
And I'm going to ask you something a little bit different now. Is what are the sort of issues you get at Barnsdale? Do you get winds? Do you get pests? Do you get, obviously, treated organic way? What are your biggest challenges?
I think you mean after the visitors, the biggest challenges?
How you go? When they're settling all over your herbs or whatever. Yeah.
I think we're heavy, very heavy clay, which I've always said to people when I do my courses and things, and I do a couple of veg courses and we talk about soil and things like that. And I say a clay soil is the best soil you can have, because at the end of the day, but then there's clay soil and there's clay soil. You know, they're not all the same. So my mum's in Northamptonshire. She's got proper grey clay, which is horrible. You know, we've got heavy clay,
but your grey clay, you know.
Yeah. it's sort of, our clay is sort of over limestone, and so, but we're at the bottom of a long gradual slope. Fields that go beyond us, they're all slopes down to us. So You know, with the weather we've just had, the ground gets very saturated and literally runs off the surface and runs straight down to us. So we got very wet and very flooded, not the buildings, but the ground over the last few weeks and months, really. And so I think the wet is one of the biggest problems we have. I think one of our great assets is the fact that we're trying to replicate as Garden Organic is as well, what people have at home. And so you don't want it to be perfect. We're all so busy these days. We don't have time like we did in the 70s where we spent 23 and a half hours a day in the garden. You know, we don't have that anymore. So the actual fact that there's always something to do is important in a garden, because if you're a gardener, you want to go out in the garden and have something to do. So the fact that not everything is pristine is great. It never runs away from us, you know, but it's not absolutely pristine. It's not a stately home type garden. So, and I think that, like I say, the pest thing, you know, we do things a lot of the time to instigate questions. So, you know, in October, we'll put October, November, we'll put a grease band around one tree on our orchard, just purely because we want people to say, what's that for? We don't have a problem with winter moth at all. We never have. But the point is that we want to instigate. So, you know, the organic thing is a great thing to be talking to people about. So there are lots of things that we don't have. So I don't have a problem with pests and disease, because it's all part of general life. I think, you know, one of our biggest problems really is the wetness of the soil. With the clay soil, is it's great because you can manipulate it to do whatever you want it to do to a point. But when you're in a situation where you level off at the bottom of a long slope, you have no control in that respect. So, you know, when it rains a lot, you know, you're going to get flooded. And therefore, even the areas that you've improved the drainage still get flooded. So it's a difficult in that respect, I think, is the hardest thing. I think the pest and disease things, we all go up and down with, you know, with pest and disease at different times of the year. We also have different crops and different plants that get affected in different years. It's never the same each year. But they're really good talking points. And that's what we like to do. You know, I view Barnsdale not as a horticultural attraction in that respect. I regard it very much as an educational facility, just the same as the gardens at Ryton, you know, because, you know, what I want is I want the garden attraction to bring people in, for people to enjoy it. They go round, even without asking questions, they'll be educating themselves by taking things in the best possible way, which is when you're enjoying yourself and you don't even know you're doing it. Yeah. If we can fill in little gaps with answers to questions as well. But people need something to see to remind them that they want to ask that question. So, you know, I don't mind pests and disease. I actually quite enjoy them because it gets us talking.
It's a conversation point. And people like, I find in my work, that people like to see the challenges and they like to see the practical solutions, don't they? They like to see the hands-on stuff, if you like.
Yeah, and I think also they like to know that they're not the only one. You know, if you've got whitefly on your brassicas and they've got whitefly on their brassicas, they go away quite happy. They were depressed before because they had them on. But, you know, you say to them, no, you know, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's not really causing any problems. You know, if you've got whitefly on the leaves of your Brussels sprout plants, as long as they're not getting into the sprouts, what's the problem? Yeah. There isn't a problem because they can cope with that. And obviously it also feeds wildlife, which is important. So, you know, and once they understand that, then they go away quite happy. But also just the fact that, you know, the professional horticulturists, professional gardeners are also suffering the same things as they are. So it does make them feel a bit better, which is great.
Yeah, it's really nice. That, getting that interaction going is spot on. And I'm going to come to the last one. I want to I know, like I said earlier, that we have listeners from all over the world. So if people wanted to find you and come and visit Barnsdale and find out, or maybe they want to buy your books, how would you give them some information so they know where you are and how they can make the most of your expertise, Nick?
Okay, well, the books are available on our website, and in the shop as well at Barnsdale. We are, as I said, in the beautiful county of Rutland, and all the information is on our website, which is just barnsdalegardens.co.uk. But we're sort of sandwiched between Oakham and Stamford, in a beautiful area. And you know, very easy to find, signposted.
Brilliant. Well, everyone who's listening, you've got to get along if you haven't been yet to Barnsdale, or go again. Nick, thanks so much. It was a really great chat. I really, really enjoyed it. I really appreciate your time. Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Hamilton.
Been a pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Right, well, time now for the postbag. And I'm joined by Anton and Chris. We've got three cracking questions this time. First one's all about Laurel. So we've had a question from Julian, who's one of our members. Hi, Julian. After pruning back a long cherry laurel hedge, I now have a large builder's bag full of shredded leaves and stems. What would you advise I do with it? Do I compost this separately or add it bit by bit to the regular compost? But why on earth is laurel a concern in the first place, Anton?
So laurel is one of those plants which indulges in biological warfare. There's quite a lot of plants that do that. And so actually, like quite a lot of plants, it produces small amounts of cyanide. So cyanide's got this slightly sort of bitter almond smell. So you get it in quite a lot of things. You get it in apple pips. You can, if you crunch on some apple pips, you can taste that slight sort of bitter almond taste. You don't really want to eat a whole cup full of apple pips. It might not do you too much good. So the same in laurel, basically. It's in all the tissues. Basically, it can release cyanide gas as well. So if you're in a really enclosed space and there's a load of laurel, it might not do you too much good. Some people are a bit concerned about perhaps transporting a load of it in the back of your car if you sort of shredded up the leaves at all. I don't know to what extent that would be a problem, but I perhaps would err on the safe side, perhaps open your car windows.
Okay, so that's why people are a little bit concerned around laurel. Obviously, keep your pets away from it, those kind of things. What would you do, Chris? Would you compost it?
I would compost it, yeah, because obviously there's not large enough amounts of cyanide in it to do any real damage. I think I'd break it down as much as I could. So I'd cut it up, maybe just put it on hard standing. You don't want to put a big wad of it in one go because you want that balance in your compost bin, don't you? You want your greens and your browns, your carbons. And so add to it bit by bit. Cut it up fine, put it somewhere hard standing, and then gradually feed it to the compost bin over time, and it'd be doing no harm at all, I should imagine.
Breaks down perfectly.
But yeah, because obviously the smaller you cut it up, the smaller you reduce it, the quicker it'll break down. And having that balance in the compost bin is important too.
Okay. Anton, any other thoughts?
I think this goes with quite a lot of things which are toxic plants, as they, the composting process breaks them down. So composting is actually fine to do that. People worried about things like rhubarb leaves as well. Again, fine to compost them.
That's very good advice. Thank you. Okay. Now, Ben has just moved into a new house and he's found a shed full of weed killer and other pesticides. How should he dispose of them? Oh, golly. Well, I'm sure we can all relate to this scenario, Chris.
Yeah, well, hopefully, as we move into the future, this will become less and less of a problem, right, as we reduce our pesticide use. But I've come across this as a gardener so many times. As you'd always go to some garden, there'd be a shed, and I found somewhere they'd been there like 20, 30 years. They'd be like oozing, and you'd be really, really dangerous. The first thing to say, if you're going to have chemicals at all, or you're worried about them, put them in a hard box. Storage is quite important. You don't want them leaking anywhere. You certainly don't want to put them anywhere near water. But what I've done in the past is I've contacted a local authority and I'll take them down to the local recycling centre and they'll dispose of them safely. And that's pretty much the idea.
Yeah. Okay. Have you had this problem, Anton?
Yeah, actually, the last house I moved into, we had exactly that. Moved into the shed and there's just shelves of sort of unpleasant chemicals in. My experience is that different authorities, it seems to vary a little bit.
Yes.
So if you're going to make a trip to the local tip, then I would ring them up first. It's certainly in Warwickshire, it seems to be sort of every third Thursday of the month between 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock, you can dispose of them. So you just got to really make
for example.
You need to make it much easier for people, don't they?
Yeah.
Because you can't have things like, I mean, there's something we were using some really powerful stuff 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And you really don't want that lying around.
No, you don't.
You really don't.
And that's why they end up on shelves, because people don't know how to dispose of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. On to something a little more natural now. Hannah has said she's read conflicting advice on whether to feed birds all the year round or to stop during the spring. And what would we recommend? And I'm quite interested in this because I think we all probably have slightly different views on this. So, Chris, first of all, what do you do?
Well, I stop.
I stop in sort of late May, early June, after they've fledged.
Right.
I will say, this time of year, they're just the light of our life at home, because everything's just full of them. And we're kind of up in the trees, you see, so we get all their nests really close to us. So there's like a constant fly of blue tit, great tit, a lot of robin, get wren up there even. Just incredible. And they just come in one after another. When I am in the top of the trees, and what I noticed in the late spring, you start to see a lot of fly life and life in the trees themselves. I'm sure they're full of caterpillar as well. So I kind of played a hard parent, really. I go, well, it's time to pull up your braces and feed yourself, I suppose. I will get into a massive discussion with it with my wife, because we just love having them around.
Yeah. So anything you can do to have them coming, especially in there. All fluffy and
at
and
the little. Moment it's just like, oh, it hits your heartstrings, it really does.
Okay, so you do stop, but you also you stop partly because you're in the canopy of the trees. I understand that, but I think there's also a philosophy behind stopping, that actually you want them to feed on the caterpillars that are on your plants, presumably.
Yeah, well, that's a lot. Some gardeners will say that. This is a grey area, to point out. And some gardeners will say, I want them feeding on the blue tits. I want them eating the cabbage white caterpillars. I want them, you know, feeding off the plants, the more natural way of doing it. And I kind of understand that. I think maybe, I don't know if you're doing any harm by carrying on feeding. I doubt you are very much. Maybe that's a personal approach or how you want to play it, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it also depends on the kind of garden you have.
Yes.
Yeah, and Anton, I mean, what's your philosophy on this?
Well, I must admit, I do carry on feeding them. From what I've seen, the jury's a bit out there as whether you should carry on feeding them or not. From what I've seen, it's said that it's not actually going to do much harm. There's always this sort of thought that, oh, they're going to get lazy and become dependent on you if you carry on feeding them. Just from my own personal point of view, I just see these parents doing loads and loads of journeys a day, sort of picking all the grubs off the plants, and I think they must need some sustenance. So
you've got parental sympathies.
Yeah. Brilliant.
So my other experience is when I have stopped feeding them, we do get a robin that comes right up to the window and gives us a really hard stare.
I don't tell you that. Sometimes they get one that pops up over the window.
I give in to him, I must admit.
I can understand that. Most people would, wouldn't they? Yeah.
I mean, I know from my experience, there is plenty of food source in my garden. But you know, perhaps if you're a gardener that doesn't have quite so many plants in their garden, and perhaps things are a little bit a little bit more Spartan, or perhaps you've got a piece of concrete that you're gardening on, then perhaps it is a good idea to keep it going all the year round, because you haven't got many other food sources that you can offer.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, I think we also need to take a sort of balanced picture and look at what we can have in our own gardens as a sort of mixed food source as well, you know, sort of. We used to always tidy up before the winter, but now we leave all the sort of heads on the plants.
It comes into the whole biodiversity thing. Yeah. You want to create as good a home as possible for your wildlife. And that in turn hopefully creates a balance between what you're trying to grow as well.
And it's amazing what they will discover, you know, things that you don't necessarily cut down. You know, I've got loads of lemon balm in my garden. I absolutely love it. And the goldfinches just love the little tiny seeds at the top. Have you noticed any favourite plants that the birds particularly love?
Well, I am a big grower of sunflowers on the allotment, because they're good. Their bees love them as well. They're really bee made. I grow them out the front of the block as well, because the kids like growing them. So it's quite a nice little communal thing. But I then harvest all those seeds and I get a big old load out of them, because I grow quite a lot, especially the Heliathus gigantica, the big sunflower. And the birds absolutely love those, you know, so I can. Not only can they feed on the plant, but I'll take them off and use them into the winter as well.
Yes.
And you put them out in the feeder and they are gone straight away.
They
devour them so quick. Teasel's another good one as well on the allotment for the blue tits. And there's plenty of stuff around for them. I think, like you say, you just need to include your planting. That's right. Sunflowers for me is the... So I get double bubble. I get the beauty of the sunflower and I get happy birds. What a win-win.
Yeah, I find the teasel's particularly good for the goldfinches. Also, I just... I mean, I find something like the climbing rose has got quite a few aphids on it, and that seems to be a real magnet for the blue tits. I get a few surprises as well. We've got a little goji berry, and for some reason that seemed to attract quite a few goldfinches. I don't know why.
Yeah, lots of different opportunities then for birds, and so don't forget to plant with birds in mind. One other point though is that a lot of us buy bird food in. Any views on that?
It's quite a tricky one, really, isn't it? Because you don't know where it's coming from quite often. I mean, sunflower seeds often a lot of those, certainly when I see in the shops, a lot of it comes from China as well. Mm-hmm. So
I think if people are out there, there's people out there, there probably will be small company who are doing sustainable bird food. That's what to look for. Yeah. A little rummage around on Google, see what's out there. But you're right, it's difficult because you don't really get that information, do you? Yeah. And it's big business, bird food, billion.
Yeah. I guess look for labels that reassure you. You know, if the RSPB are recommending it, it's probably okay, for example.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you to Fiona.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this month's episode of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'd just like to thank our sponsors, Viridian Nutrition. I'd also like to say thank you to everyone who's donated their Yo Valley Yokens to us. If you've got some yokens that you're not using, there's still time to donate them. Just log in at the Yo Valley website and select Garden Organic from the charity donation options. We're also giving away over 170,000 packets of herb seeds with Yo Valley spreadable packs. You can find these at your local supermarket. We'd love to see photos of your herbs growing, so do send them to us on social media at Garden Organic UK. Last but not least, if you're enjoying the Organic Gardening Podcast on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. This will help us spread the organic message even further. That's it for this month. Thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the music.